37 degrees across the board, Kenosha, Racine, Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. As I'm sure you are already well aware, it was 60 years ago today that President John F. Kennedy was assassinated. We have two special interviews for you today, both from the morning show archives. The first, which originally was broadcast back in 2007, features attorney Vincent Bugliosi talking about his highly acclaimed analysis of the assassination titled Reclaiming History. Part two, a slightly more recent interview, concerns the thousands of letters of condolence that were sent to Jacqueline Kennedy in the wake of her husband's assassination. Here's part one of today's program.
This time of year, of course, brings to mind not only cornucopias and hymns of thanksgiving, but also, of course, for many Americans, November also brings back very disturbing, heartbreaking memories of 1963 and the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. In fact, it's probably fair to say that you don't even have to be of a certain political persuasion or have been an admirer of President Kennedy to have been at that time and maybe to this day deeply shaken by the events in Dallas. So much has been written about the assassination of President Kennedy since it occurred. And in many respects, a book which may go down in history as the definitive analysis of it has just been published, called Reclaiming History, The Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. And it is written by Vincent Bugliosi, and perhaps you know him for one of the most famous true crime bestsellers ever written, Helter Skelter. He has written other books, of course, as well, and his work as a trial lawyer makes him, in many respects, uniquely qualified to analyze the events of November 22nd, 1963, and perhaps most tellingly in this book, much of what has happened after it, much of the slanted and flawed analysis of those events. And again, all of that painstaking work done over the course of many years is found in the pages of this sprawling book called Reclaiming History. And I'm very pleased for the next few minutes to be able to speak with Vincent Bugliosi. Mr. Bugliosi, we welcome you to the morning show.
Good morning, Greg. I appreciate your having me on the show very much.
Good to have you here. I appreciate this opportunity to speak with you. In some respects, you are taking on an absolutely gigantic task in that you are not only trying to offer the finest sort of analysis of what happened so many years ago, but also taking on, one after another, the plethora of conspiracy theories which have sprung up ever since. What is the driving motivation which inspires you to take all of this on?
Yeah. Well, it all started in 1986, Greg, when London Weekend Television, a British production company, called me and wanted me to, quote, prosecute Oswald for the Kennedy assassination. And Jerry Spence, you've heard of him, perhaps. He defended Oswald. And my initial reaction was I was not interested because I thought it was just a typical television fare. But when they told me what they were planning, my misgivings quickly dissolved. They were planning the closest to a real trial that Oswald would ever have. In fact, Time magazine in their review of the docu-trial said it was the closest to a real trial that the accused assassin, President Kennedy, would likely ever have.
This is not going to be the typical artificial television fare you were so suspicious of.
Yeah, not at all. It was going to be 21 hours. They only showed five over here, but over in Europe they showed much more than five. They had the original Warren Commission witnesses. So if I had prosecuted Oswald in real life, these are the people that I would have needed. The great lawyer Spence was defending Oswald. And perhaps most importantly of all, he said, "Mr. Bugliosi, we know about your love affair with your yellow pad, and there's not going to be any script. The yellow pad is going to be your script." So this was not scripted. This was not typical television fare. We had a regular federal judge, a regular federal jury. We had over 5 months or close to 5 months to prepare it. And Spence will tell you the same thing that I'm going to tell you now, that he and I worked on this case just as hard as any other murder case in our respective careers. And the jury eventually came back with a verdict of guilty. It was a Dallas jury. They flew all of us over to London, and we tried the case in an exact replica of a Dallas federal courtroom.
In fact, if I can just jump in, I thought it was interesting that that decision got made at some point. This trial was going to take place in Dallas, and the decision was made in the interest of not turning it into more of a media circus than it might otherwise be.
That's right.
To have it not occur there. That really says something, I think, about the people who organized this effort.
Yeah, they quietly jetted us to London, so no one knew about it. Because, these witnesses, Greg, they had been harassed by the media for years. This was 1986, which would be, 23 years after the assassination. And by that point, they had been called hundreds of times, by members of the media. And they would either slam the door in the reporter's face or hang up the phone or whatever. But one inducement for this, of course, they were offered a trip to London for themselves and a spouse, staying at a five-star hotel over there. So that kind of weakened their opposition. And they testified in London, and everyone took it very, very, very seriously. And in preparing for the trial, I found out that although the conspiracy theorists had been accusing the Warren Commission for years of bias and distorting the evidence and suppressing the truth from the American people, I found out that it was they who were guilty of these precise things. I didn't know that until I got into the case. And I also found that there was no merit, no substance at all to these conspiracy theories. At first blush, some of them were appealing to the intellectual palate, but upon sober scrutiny, in fact, the weakest of microscopes, they did complete violence to all conventional notions of logic and common sense. And yet I knew that the majority of American people had bought into it, that they believed in this nonsense, and they were rejecting the findings of the Warren Commission. So, long answer to your question, it was at that point, way back in 1986, that I decided to do a book on the case, and it turned out to be Reclaiming History, a very, very long book. I've had three other books. I got up to number one on the New York Times bestseller list, but I have to say, and being candid with you, that Reclaiming History clearly is my so-called magnum opus, the book of my career. The Kennedy case is the most important murder case in American history, arguably altered the course of history. I don't think we would have had the Vietnam War if Kennedy had not been killed. That's not a positive or a certainty, but I don't think we would have. And I worked on the book for over 20 years. In the meantime, I also did other things, like writing Outrage on the Simpson case. But the main book always on my desk was the Kennedy assassination. And I did not write the book for money. I certainly hope, don't get me wrong, I certainly hope that it would make money. But that was not my main motivation. With the increasing superficiality of our society and fewer and fewer people are reading books, if you want to make money, you do not put out a book of 1,600 pages that costs $50, although I understand on Amazon.com it's a lot cheaper. But the CD alone is another 1,000 pages. So we're talking about the equivalent of 13 volumes of 400-page books. And if you're after money, you don't put out a book like that.
Right. I mean, this is, in every sense of the word, this is a serious book for people seriously interested in the Kennedy assassination.
Yeah. It's also, my editor said, Vince, you don't realize what you're doing here, but you're writing the history of the era. And I was unaware of that because I was just writing the whole story, the complete 100% whole story. He said, but, you're weaving one historical event after another into the narrative as it relates to the assassination. And when I stopped to think about it, he was right. Because, I write about the Bay of Pigs invasion, the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Gulf of Tonkin, the Vietnam War, the Civil Rights Movement. All of those things are incorporated into the book. And I'm proud of the book. And I did not write it again for the bestseller list. I wrote it, and this is, I'm being candid, my state of mind as I was writing this book is I want to write a book for the ages. And I was very honored when the LA Times in the review of the book said, finally, someone has done it, put all the pieces together. Reclaiming History is a book for the ages. The Wall Street Journal said the book should be right next to the two major federal investigations of this case. That's the Warren Commission and the House Select Committee on Assassinations. But you got to realize, Jim, that both of those investigative bodies had quite a few lawyers and investigators and a multi-million-dollar budget. Scott Turow, the great American novelist, just gave a review saying that centuries from now, people will be reading Reclaiming History. And I think all of this is the reason why Tom Hanks and his people are going to be doing a 10-hour miniseries for HBO on the book. So I'm proud of the book. It's a complete story. And those who have read the book agree that there's no question Oswald killed Kennedy and acted alone.
We're speaking with Vincent Bugliosi, and we're talking about his book, Reclaiming History. The title of one of the first so-called conspiracy books to be published was Rush to Judgment.
Right.
And I think it makes sense for us to talk for just a moment about that perception by some conspiracy theorists and by some in the public at the time and since that somehow the Warren Commission, which of course was the official body charged with investigating the assassination, somehow rushed to its conclusions in relatively careless fashion, or maybe not out of sheer carelessness, but out of a sense of needing to tie all of this up very quickly. What is your most essential response to that charge?
Well, you know, I'm a very critical person. Although I give credit where it's due, too, but I'm a very critical person. I told Geraldo Rivera one time, I said on TV, I said, Geraldo, I would find fault with a beautiful morning sunrise. So I'm very critical, but I can tell you that the Warren Commission did a heck of a job here, an extremely thorough examination of the assassination. These people that are saying this about the Warren Commission, they have absolutely no background in law enforcement. The FBI, the chief investigative arm of the Warren Commission, conducted 25,000 interviews. No murder case in history has ever been investigated as thoroughly as the Warren Commission and the FBI and other agencies investigated this particular case. It wasn't just the rush to judgment that they claimed. Worse than that, they claimed that there really were two conspiracies here. The first conspiracy is that the CIA or the mob or the military-industrial complex was involved behind the assassination. And then the Warren Commission, if you're to believe these conspiracy theorists, like Mark Lane, they find out the truth. They find out the truth that there was a conspiracy, and they got together in this back room. These are very honorable people, like Chief Justice Earl Warren, Jerry Ford, who went on to become president, very honorable people. And apparently they got together in a back room, there's no other inference to draw from these books, and decided to suppress the truth from the American people. So you got two conspiracies. One, the conspiracy to kill Kennedy, and then the conspiracy by the Warren Commission to suppress the truth. And I talk about Mark Lane in the book. I have a whole chapter on him, and his book is just one distortion after another. You know, he'll just take the evidence and either distort it, or what he does, another thing that he does, and a lot of these conspiracy theorists do, if there's a piece of evidence that goes in the opposite direction of some theory they're propounding, they just ignore it. You look in the index, and there's no name. The guy who arrested Oswald in the theater, I think that's pretty important. Oswald resisted arrest, pulled a gun on the arresting officer. He's not in the book. He's not in Mark Lane's book.
there's a lot of selective use of evidence and information at work here.
And I don't do that because my orientation as a trial lawyer is you don't do that. Credibility means everything to me. I have no other master. I have no other mistress. If a jury or a reader of a true crime book, but if a jury suspects that you're playing with the evidence, you're trying to distort things, you lose your credibility and you've lost the case. So I don't do that. Every argument against the Warren Commission, every argument in favor of conspiracy, it's in my book, Reclaiming History, the way the propounder wants it to be set forth, and then I proceed to dismantle it. But I don't ignore it, and I don't twist the facts. Now, there's no question that someone's going to come up with some document that I haven't seen. There's millions of documents in the National Archives, but they're not going to be able to, because I just don't do this. It's not my style. They're not going to be able to come up with any statement like this. Mr. Bugliosi quotes from this document, the first paragraph, that points in the direction of the position that he's espousing. Then he conveniently neglects to mention the second paragraph, which completely qualifies the first paragraph. That's not going to happen. I don't do that. And the conspiracy theorists are having a devil of a time with this book. It's their whole life. They go to conventions down in Dallas. They subscribe to newsletters. And this book is staggering to them because I know I've talked to people in the conspiracy community. They do not know what to do with this book. Some of them have jumped ship. Vince Palomara, he was a confirmed conspiracy theorist. He's given a review for the book, and he said, let me just read you a couple of the words. He says, Vince Bugliosi's Masterful Reclaiming History is a devastating knockout blow to those who, like me, once believed there was a conspiracy in the death of JFK. Bugliosi finishes and completes in exhaustive and impressive detail the work of the Warren Commission, the House Select Committee, and quite frankly, all the other writers who have ever delved into the crime of the 20th century. And he says, it is time to get a life, America. Oswald did indeed kill Kennedy acting alone. Bugliosi has done what I once thought was the impossible. He has convinced me of this notion. Then he says, the conspiracy community was able to survive the Warren Commission report as well as the report of the House Select Committee on Assassinations. The question is whether it will be able to survive Bugliosi's reclaiming history. Another person that was even higher up in the conspiracy community than Palomara, although Palomara's were very high up, but this is Dr. David Mantic. He's among the top two or three conspiracy theorists in the country, and he found fault with the book, and he's probably still a member of the community, but he gave a review of the book saying, quote, it is likely that reclaiming history will stand forever as the magnum opus of this case. It is a masterpiece, unquote. So the conspiracy community is having a lot of difficulty with this book. Gerald Posner wrote a good book on the assassination, Case Closed, years ago. But there were two problems with it. Number one, it wasn't quite complete. I mean, there was all types of things that were not discovered, but it was a good book, and I gave him credit for that. But the big problem is that what he did in his book is very similar to what the conspiracy theorists like Mark Lane do on the other side. When he found something that was antithetical to a position he was taking, he either ignored it or many times, and I point out in the book, he distorted it, and the conspiracy community savaged Posner. They're not savaging me. They're savaging me to this extent. A lot of them will say something on Amazon.com, don't read this book, it's a pack of lies, and that's all they say.
That's all they probably can say.
Well, they haven't even read the book. They haven't read the book, yeah. But when you read a thorough review of the book by conspiracy theorists who have read it, they're having all types of problems with this book because they can't say, well, you'll see lied here and he lied there. They can say the book is a pack of lies, but that's nonsense. They haven't even read the book. I don't deliberately lie. Forget about the ethics of it. Forget about the ethics that I don't lie. All human beings, by the way, lie. But I do not lie in front of a jury or in a true crime book for a self-serving reason. If you do that and it's discovered, the duplicity is discovered, you lose all credibility.
Well, and that's one of your essential points about the Warren Commission, just to get back to the original question, the fact that for this room full of men, including the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court and a future president, Gerald Ford, I mean, they would have lost everything that meant anything to them.
Absolutely.
If they had been party to some sort of a cover-up conspiracy. I mean, that idea is preposterous, and it is the kind of theory that bears the entire burden of proof. I mean, when you are making a preposterous claim like that, it is your burden of proof to prove it true, not for people like you to have to prove that claim false.
Your articulation was beautiful, and I'm going to have to plagiarize you on it, but I hope I will mention that you're the one that came up with it, but they would have lost everything that meant anything to them. I think that's the way you said it, and that's a beautiful articulation. Their legacy, once it was discovered, would have been that they participated in covering up the assassination of a president, and it would have destroyed their legacy. And you know, when you're at that age, older, that means everything to you, your legacy. And not only that, but they would have been guilty of a serious crime, accessory after the fact to murder. And it's preposterous that these people would have done that. And yet, book after book on the assassination claims the Warren Commission suppressed the truth from the American people.
Well, that's where so many of these arguments begin. You also mentioned something which is a very obvious point, but so important, and it's also a thread woven through many of your rebuttals, the fact that people just are rotten when it comes to keeping secrets. And the idea that something as grandiose and as terrible as this could be kept a secret all these years.
Yeah, I told the jury in London, I said, I'll stipulate to you folks that three people can keep a secret, I said, but only if two are dead. And here now, close to 44 years later, you know, this coming Thursday is the 44th anniversary of the assassination, not one single word, not one single syllable has ever leaked out, no credible word has ever leaked out that there was a conspiracy here. And the reason nothing has leaked out is there's nothing to leak out. And Time magazine gave me a page about 2-3 months ago to try to summarize why there was no conspiracy, and that was one of the points that I made, that you can't keep a secret. And here you have two vast conspiracies. Well, one, very vast, the whole world's involved, and the second one is the conspiracy by the Warren Commission to cover up the truth. Not one word is ever leaked out. All you have is wild speculation. I also pointed out in the Time piece that there's no evidence that Oswald ever had any association with any of these groups believed to be behind the assassination. And the FBI conducted 25,000 interviews. They checked every breath this guy ever breathed from the moment he arrived back from the Soviet Union on June 13, 1962, up until the day of the assassination. They found no evidence that he was ever connected in any way with any of these groups alleged to be behind assassinations. Then I gave two other points of time. I'll try to summarize it. I said, even if we assume, for the sake of argument, that one of these groups was behind the assassination, and between you and me, I reject that completely out of hand, Greg. Just take the CIA for an example. Who was the head of the CIA at the time of the assassination? Well, his name was John McCone. Who's John McCone? John McCone was a personal friend of John F. Kennedy. He appointed McCone director of the CIA, and McCone's going to turn around and kill him, I guess, because he wasn't invited to some affair at the White House. In any event, I rejected out of hand, although in my book, I didn't have the luxury of doing that. Reclaiming History is the only book that's ever been published on the case that goes into great depth on every single one of these conspiracy theories. I have a whole chapter. I kind of went off on a tangent here, but let's assume that the CIA wanted to kill the president or the mob. Oswald would have been the last person or one of the last people they would have looked to be the hitman. Why? He was not an expert shot. He was a good shot, but he was not an expert shot. He had a $12 mail order rifle, extremely unstable. Here's a guy who defects to the Soviet Union pre-Gorbachev. Even today, who in the world defects to the Soviet Union? Then he gets over there, desperately wants to become a Soviet citizen. He's turned down. What does he do? He slashes his wrist, tries to commit suicide. Just the type of person, I'm being sarcastic now, Greg, but just the type of person that the CIA or mob would want to rely upon to commit the biggest murder in American history.
He would be a incredibly poor choice for
absolutely
such an assignment.
Just unbelievably bad. Fourth point that I made for Time magazine. Assuming, nonetheless, irrespective of what I just told you, that they still wanted to kill the president and they wanted Oswald to be their hitman. Let's see if where that takes us makes any sense. After Oswald shot Kennedy in Dealey Plaza and left the building, one of two things would have happened. Let me tell you the least likely thing that would have happened. The least likely thing is that there would have been a car waiting for him to help him escape down to Mexico, Costa Rica, wherever. Certainly the conspirators would not want to have their hitman apprehended and interrogated by the authorities. That's the least likely thing that would have happened. The most likely thing, Greg, and I think you know what I'm going to say before I say it, it's obvious. If the CIA or Bob got Oswald to kill Kennedy for them, there would have been a car waiting for him to drive him to his death. I mean, you know that would have happened. And yet we know that Oswald was out on the street with $13 in his pocket trying to flag down buses and cabs. No rational person looking at just these couple points here, and in the book I set forth 32 reasons why there was no conspiracy. These are just some of the main ones. No rational person could possibly believe that there was any group behind Oswald under the circumstances that I just mentioned to you. In fact, the presidential motorcade route, which took the limousine right below Oswald's window at the book depository building, that wasn't even determined until November 18th, 4 days before the assassination. Who could possibly believe that some group like the FBI or KGB or CIA would conspire with Oswald to kill Kennedy within just 4 days of the president's visit to Dallas? It's just silly on its face.
Right. You say, and I think you say this so well, one of the principal frailties in the thinking processes of the theorists is that they rarely ever carry their suspicions, which are based on some discrepancy, anomaly, or contradiction they find, to their logical conclusion.
Right.
I mean, that's what a good lawyer does, of course, in trying to really seek out the truth.
Right.
And a conspiracy theorist only takes things as far as they can.
Right.
And when it gets to the pushing, and when it gets to the pushing point, then they have to back away, because all conspiracy theories lead us back to ultimately to your conclusion.
Right, right.
I mean, nothing stands up.
Yeah, I'll just give you one example of that, and again, you articulated it very well. The autopsy technically should have been conducted in Dallas, Texas, because that's where the assassination took place. But Kennedy's people and Jackie wanted to get the body out of there as quickly as possible. This horrible, unimaginable thing had happened in Dallas, and they wanted to get out of Dallas as quickly as possible. So the Secret Service and Jackie, but Secret Service, they were the ones that were using the muscle. They literally forced that body out of Parkland Hospital to get on a plane and take it back to Dallas. And the conspiracy theorists in book after book say this is indicative of something very, very suspicious here. Why was the body taken out of Dallas back to Bethesda in Bethesda, Maryland? They draw all types of inferences from that. But what they don't want to say is that, okay, if this is bad, then what in the world are you saying? Are you saying that the Secret Service and Jackie were involved in the assassination or the attempt to cover it up? Because if you're not saying that, what relevance does it have? The Secret Service is the one, they're the ones that forced the body out of the hospital and brought it back to Bethesda. Unless you're willing to say that the Secret Service was a part of the conspiracy, what is your point? Well, they don't talk about that. All they talk about is the Secret Service took the body away from Parkland, and they should not have done it. But are they saying that the group that was responsible for taking a bullet, standing in, you know about the Reagan situation where he was shot at, and then the second bullet was taken by a Secret Service guy who just spread-eagled his body right in front of Reagan. They're trained to take a bullet for the president. Are you saying the Secret Service was involved in the assassination? Well, most of them don't say that. Some do. But most of them don't. The vast majority don't. They say the CIA or the mob was, but not the Secret Service. Well, if the Secret Service was not involved, then what they did in Dallas in taking that body away from Parkland, by definition, was an innocent thing. And if it's innocent, why are we talking about it?
Hmm. So in some ways, your book, Reclaiming History, is not only about the assassination of John F. Kennedy and who did it, and dismantling the conspiracy theories that have sprung up around it. But in a sense, reading your book can help us understand the process by which someone can examine a question carefully and rationally and thoroughly, something which just doesn't happen very much anymore.
Well, you know, again, I'm not boasting, but it's just factual. I have a background, you know, in prosecuting murder cases. I prosecuted 21 successful murder cases in L.A. when I was down at the DA's office. And if you look at the authors of these other books, 99 out of 100 of them have no connection whatsoever with law enforcement, much less being a prosecutor of murder cases. And when you're a prosecutor, you got the burden of, you were talking about the burden, you know, if you make an allegation, you have to prove it. The prosecutor has the burden of proof. He doesn't just say someone is guilty. He's got to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. So my whole orientation was in taking a case, looking at the evidence, and seeing if there's enough to convict. And in this case here, whom I've convicted is not anyone for killing Kennedy, other than Oswald, of course, but I've convicted the conspiracy theorists of making wild allegations and not supporting anything. I've taken all of their theories and shown how preposterous they are, that they don't really, as they say in the legal profession, they don't go anywhere.
Hmm. The book, again, is called Reclaiming History, The Assassination of President John F. Kennedy, and there is a website where you can learn more, reclaiminghistory.com. Vincent Bugliosi, I was honored to speak with you today on The Morning Show. My thanks to you.
Honored to be interviewed by you, Greg. I mean that.
You're listening to The Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We turn next to an interview I was privileged to record back in 2010 with historian Ellen Fitzpatrick, talking about her remarkable book, Letters to Jackie, Condolences from a Grieving Nation. Jacqueline Kennedy, in the wake of her husband's assassination, received over a million letters and cards of condolence from not only Americans, but from people from other countries as well. And Ellen Fitzpatrick carefully combed through thousands of those letters and actually presents excerpts from 250 of them in this beautifully written book published by Echo.
Well, I actually stumbled across this collection by accident. I was on my way to the Kennedy Library one day last year, and I was in the midst of a different research project. And as part of that project, I wanted to try to get a sense of how Americans saw President Kennedy in his own time. There's been so much written about him since his assassination, now almost 50 years ago, that I wanted to try to peel back some of those layers and get a sense of how it looked in 1963. It just popped into my mind that Mrs. Kennedy had received, I remembered, millions of condolence letters. And I had recalled seeing her on television, I was only 11 years old, thanking the public for those letters some 7 weeks after the assassination. So I went into the John F. Kennedy Library. I asked the archivist if he had any of the letters. He brought up the first couple of boxes for me to look at, and it was, you know, I was hooked from that moment on.
Is it really as simple a matter as that? I mean, could I have gone up to that desk and asked to see those letters?
You certainly could have.
Wow.
This is the presidential libraries, which are part of our National Archives system, are absolutely extraordinary resources for all of us as Americans to learn about the presidencies of our country and the various presidents and their both their private papers, their letters to constituents, letters constituents wrote to them. And these letters were all sitting there waiting for their historian.
Hmm. Let's talk a moment about how these letters came to be written. That's not really what I mean. How they were received, what was done with these letters upon receipt. That in and of itself, I think, is a very, very interesting story. And among other things, we learned from your book that these letters began coming to the White House the Monday after the president was assassinated. I mean, immediately in the aftermath of the tragedy, some of these letters were written and sent and received.
Yes, there was an absolute avalanche of mail on the Monday following the assassination, which took place on a Friday. And Mrs. Kennedy's very small staff was totally overwhelmed by the volume of mail, which began being stacked up and was, you know, spilling out into hallways. It was Mrs. Kennedy's determination that every single one of these letters, 1.5 million in all, would be opened, read, and acknowledged. And she had a staff of volunteers who, over the ensuing few years, actually helped with that process. So it was a long process, but each person who wrote received in return a black-bordered card with a statement from Mrs. Kennedy thanking them for the expression of condolence. Many people asked for things. They wanted copies of the mass cards that were printed for President Kennedy's funeral. They wanted pictures of President Kennedy or of Mrs. Kennedy or a picture of the family, of the children. And those requests were often acknowledged as well. Some wanted PT-109 clips that the president used to like to give out to visitors and at campaign stops, and some of those were sent too.
Tell us exactly where those letters were in those first few weeks. I mean, for instance, after Mrs. Kennedy had left the White House, I think some 11 days later, you tell us, did these letters follow her, or exactly where were they housed?
She was given space. She was given office space by the federal government in a nearby building so that she would be able to, she and her staff could begin to cope with the task of answering these letters. And so that process began, as you said, in Washington, it followed her to New York City when she moved there in the summer of 1964. A few rooms were set aside in the executive office building right next to the White House after she had left the White House. But pretty soon thereafter, they needed additional space, and they rented space in a downtown office building in Washington.
You mentioned this televised statement to the public. I didn't see it when it first happened. I was only three at the time, but I have seen it since on video. A beautiful, eloquent expression of appreciation to the nation. One of the things she says is something about, you know, I appreciate all these letters, and I read some of them when I can bear to,
yes,
or words to that effect. Do we know, I don't recall reading in your book specifically, and maybe this question can't be definitively answered, but do we really know to what extent Jacqueline Kennedy, in fact, could bear to read any of these letters of condolence?
I think she certainly read some of them. I have no doubt about that. We don't know how many she read, but what we do know that I think is so important is that she spoke in that message about her wish that each and every message, she said, is to be treasured not only for my children, but so that future generations will know how much our country and people of other nations thought of him. And she said to the public, "Your letters will be placed with his papers in the Kennedy Library." And so we do know that she was she understood the significance of these letters. And in the summer of 1966, when the staff was still sifting through these letters, her secretary told the New York Times that she didn't want to throw anything away. She felt that it all came from the heart, and her secretary was quoted as saying, "Who is to know in the future how much any letter or poem or painting will show about how people felt? We are doing all we can so it will be available for work by scholars." And for 46 years, the letters pretty much sat there without much attention.
I thought it was interesting that in addition to Jacqueline Kennedy evidently understanding the importance of these letters, which I really think is extraordinary. I mean, that given what she had experienced, that would be so clear to her, even at a mm-hmm. time when she was grappling with her own overwhelming grief. But this was also evident to others. You, in fact, at one point in the book, quote a letter from evidently an ordinary citizen, sort of touching on the very same thing. In fact, it might be one of the last
yes.
letters you print, I think, in the book. A woman named Grace Longenecker, I believe,
yes.
In her own letter of condolence to Mrs. Kennedy, says, "I hope something is done with these letters so that they are gathered together and someday can be seen by the public." I thought that was extraordinary.
That's a wonderful letter. It's such a thoughtful letter. She talks about her awareness of the fact that Mrs. Kennedy had gotten all of these letters and how much she hoped that it would be possible for her to share them. And she said that they would have merit as a collection to Mr. Kennedy's memory, But she says as well, there will be letters from those who have been widowed or bereaved, who have bestowed their own endurance, faith, and courage on you in an effort to carry you through. And then there's a wonderful line when she says, "My parents are aging. Everyone I love is mortal. I want such a chapter for my own. Would you share the letters with us all? Would you give us the book?"
Hmm. And I love the line right after that. "I don't know what to wish for you except God bless."
Yes.
I know that at one point also in one of your editor notes, you mentioned that the great anthropologist Margaret Mead also one way or another weighed in
mm-hmm.
on the importance of these letters. And she made a suggestion, which ultimately was followed in terms of how these letters would be sort of gathered together and organized. Tell us what her suggestion was and to what extent her suggestion was carried out.
Yes, that was fascinating. I learned from Nancy Tuckerman, Mrs. Kennedy's secretary, that a word was passed to Nancy Tuckerman from a cousin of hers who knew Margaret Mead, the great anthropologist, and Mead had suggested that these letters, she was aware that the White House was being flooded with them, should be carefully sorted out, and adult letters should be separated from children's letters and people who had personal remembrances of President Kennedy who had met him and commented, because she thought they would be an incredible resource for future scholars trying to understand this time and the reaction of the American people to this event. And so she suggested that they be sorted out, that they be notated, ones that were especially touching, ones from, you know, very young children, ones from elderly folks. And that is exactly what this staff of volunteers did. And when you look at the letters, you can sometimes see in a red pencil a note that one of the volunteers has written. For instance, it will say, "From a 99-year-old man," or whatever. And those categorizations, you know, help the archivist, I think, divide up the letters.
So as you... Oh, one other question about sort of what was done with these letters, and then we'll get to the assemblage of your book. At one point, you mention ultimately what was done with this enormous group of letters. And again, you tell us, I think, maybe 1.4 million letters, and you try to sort of graphically describe to us what that looks like. I mean, if you lay the boxes end to end, I mean, how far they reach. Ultimately, what was done, how many of these letters were kept, and so on. Can you explain that?
Sure. When the letters were, as I said, the letters were opened and they were acknowledged, all the original letters. And these letters were not just from Americans. They were from every corner of the globe, often people writing in their own languages. My book and my research focused on the letters from Americans, but there's a great deal of foreign mail as well. When they were turned over to the Kennedy Library in the mid-1960s, the National Archives made a decision to cull the collection. That is, they destroyed many of these letters because they didn't have any way of managing the size of the collection. They thought it would simply overwhelm the library to try to keep all this material. And so they had a team of archivists who went through and basically picked representative samples of the letters. And they also, however, and this was very important, they kept 3,000 letters of the original inflow. That is, so a future scholar could look at these letters and get a sense of what the collection looked like before it had been reviewed by the archivists. So both things were there. And in the end, what was left were about 15,000 condolence letters from Americans, many, many more letters from around the world. There are some 80 boxes of foreign mail. There's also a lot of material such as poems, sermons, essays, photographs, physical objects, painting, art. But again, my letter focuses on those 15. I read the 15,000 letters from Americans, and that became the basis of my book.
We are talking with Ellen Fitzpatrick about her book, Letters to Jackie, Condolences from a Grieving Nation. So as you began looking at these letters, first of all, how were you, are they in boxes? Are they in folders? Were they grouped by category? I mean, and exactly how did you sort of make your way through them?
Well, the processed letters, that is, most of the collection, are in archive boxes, and they're all very nicely arranged for scholars or interested researchers. And when you open the archive box, there are usually about 8 file folders, and within each file folder, there might be the number of letters in each file folder vary. There might be 15, there might be 25. So it was simply a matter of sitting there and reading through each one of these folders. I was also given access to the 3,000 unprocessed letters. Those were 3 large archive boxes that were literally stuffed with letters, not in folders, not in boxes. But since my research, I understand the library has begun processing that part of the collection as well.
As you began looking at these letters, right from the beginning, was it your intention that a book would result with a collection of them? Was that always sort of your intention?
No, not at all, Gray. And this is interesting because I was a fellow last year at the Radcliffe Institute when I began this research. And I would go back to the scholars that I was spending the year with at Radcliffe, and I would say, you know, I'm reading these incredible letters, and I'm beginning to think that this is the book I should write. And they, you know, some of them, they all listened politely and looked a little skeptical, and then I would say, no, you have to listen to this letter. And pretty soon, I think they saw me coming down the hallway, you know, with a yellow Xerox copy in my hand and were hiding in their offices from me because I was trying to buttonhole people to listen to these incredible letters that I was finding. And then I decided, I would say fairly quickly, that this really, I really felt like this would be an important book to write. I, however, found out that the copyright for the letters belonged to the letter writer, even though the letters were in the National Archives, to the letter writer or to his or her heir for a period of 90 years. So to do a book was going to mean that I was going to have to find these people or their family members nearly 50 years later. And that's when I started telling people that, then eyebrows shot up, and I was very confident, ridiculously so. I mean, it turned out that we did find most people what we wanted to, but it wasn't easy.
I want to ask you about the skepticism of some of your colleagues, mm-hmm. because, of course, now as we read this book, and particularly with your editorial headings, I mean, explaining a certain body of letters and what those letters tell us about us as a nation at that moment. I mean, this just makes all the sense in the world, of course. Why hasn't somebody done this long before you did? I'm a little bit amazed and disheartened that your colleagues wouldn't understand the enormous potential and historic importance of a project like this. Can you explain their skepticism? I mean, in what way did this not, why wouldn't this make sense to them, of all people?
Well, I think that they understood that the letters were extremely moving and they were very compelling. They certainly thought that finding these folks was perhaps going to be an impossible task. And the other thing I think that we often don't think about, and I certainly didn't, having written, you know, previous works of history, it's not all that easy to put together a collection of letters and have it hang together and be a compelling reading experience. This was, to me, an opportunity to see how so-called ordinary Americans responded to a cataclysmic historical event. We often don't get that opportunity, but how to arrange the letters, how to write a narrative around the letters, that really proved to be the heart of my task as the author of the book, and it was a very interesting one. But I think my colleagues appreciated you know, the difficulty of that task.
Ellen Fitzpatrick's book is titled Letters to Jackie, Condolences from a Grieving Nation, published by Echo. You can hear this interview in its entirety by turning to the podcast version of The Morning Show. Look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. And as part of the podcast offerings today, there is also an entirely different interview also available for your listening today on the 60th anniversary of JFK's assassination. An interview from 20 years ago with Kathy Trost with the Newseum, talking about the book President Kennedy Has Been Shot.